This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Special closing night event with Don Watson. I'm Sophie Black, Director of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, and I will now hand over to your host for this evening, the wonderful Jennifer Byrne.
Thanks, Sophie, and thanks to you all. What a great turnout in this fantastic building. It's beautiful. Just a really quick, I am Jennifer Byrne indeed. Welcome to you. I acknowledge that today we are gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with the land, and we acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and of course we offer our respect to their elders past and present. If I could encourage you just to double check that you have in fact put your mobile phones off or turned them to silent. Unauthorised recordings of any kind are not permitted during this session, but it is being recorded on audio by Radio Adelaide for broadcast and future podcasts. Now, there really is, I think you'd agree, there is no bad time to hear Don Watson speak, but this surely is a particularly good time, within spitting memory of an election which was both deeply dull in the broad, because we did, after all, know who was going to win the election, it was just by how many seats. But as always in a political campaign, it did have its fascinating moments. Two that stood out for me, I must say, were seeing how very, very quiet Julia Gillard could be on the subject of Kevin Rudd. Not a word, which is very impressive. And, of course, how much love Julie Bishop could express for Tony Abbott without actually causing anyone to retch. That was good. We were taking bets. Now, since then, of course, we've had Tony Abbott promising a respite from negativism, as my kid says to me, "Well, look who's talking, Mum," and a Labor leadership contest in which the two contenders outdid themselves in mutual generosity. Shame. No one mentioned that new approach to Nicola Roxon, but let's face it, who didn't enjoy when she tripped at the niceness tape and slagged her former boss as a bastard? Don Watson has the perfect skill set, as they say in managerial circles, to assess where we've been and where we are now, politically and otherwise. An historian by training, he's also a hugely admired satirist, essayist, and screenwriter. A former political speechwriter, first for John Cain in Victoria and then in the early 90s when he was lured into the office of PM Paul Keating. His book about that time, Recollections of a Bleeding Heart, which I'm sure many of you know, it became an instant classic and a multiple prize winner, as was American Journeys, about his 6 months or so travelling along the railways and highways of that country. Don Watson has also, over the years, developed an absolute genius for sniffing out cant, hypocrisy, and the sort of grand-sounding rubbish to which he gave the memorable collective name, Weasel Words. His books on and around the subject were great fun. They sold a mozza, but they also left us to ruminate, which I use in the sense of combining thinking with to chew on, to ruminate on the link between a decaying language and a degraded democracy. This may be among the things he talks about tonight. Who knows? The subject is our poisonous politics, but as I said, it is always a good time to hear from Don Watson. The plan is that Don will speak for a while alone, and then we'll be chatting briefly, a couple of questions, and then we'll be throwing it open to the audience, to you, for the last 10 minutes or so for questions and answers. So I would invite you, without further messing about, to give a warm welcome to this Festival of Ideas closing speaker, Don Watson.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jennifer. And let me begin by telling you that when I was about 14, I had an idea. I'm not unaware that this is a festival of ideas, or of the danger of my making this a dying fall for the festival, but at 14 I had an idea, and it was to build a canoe, which probably owes as much to the past as it does to the future. That is, I was answering some ancestor, I think, who had got around in a canoe. Anyway, my canoe sank immediately and took me with it in a pair of gumboots on a grey winter's night. And my recollection is that I walked across the bottom of our dam and climbed up the side and didn't drown, miraculously. Had I drowned, they would still be looking for me, because it was South Gippsland, where the dams never dry up, and it would be one of the great mysteries for Poo Wong where I went. At 15, I had another idea, and that was, in the great traditions which South Australians will understand of agriculture and innovation, the crows were eating the grass seed that my father had sown. So I thought that if I got up in the top, in the 8 inches between the top strata of hay bales and the roof of the hay shed, with the shotgun, I may catch a crow flying overhead and blow it away from a very excitingly close distance. And enchanted I was, as a crow duly took off and, as if attracted to the glint of my shotgun barrel, flew within 3 feet, at which point, I don't know whether it was out of sympathy for the crow whose eyes I could now see, or out of some realization that if I fired a shotgun in that closed space, my head would probably be separated from my body, at least. And once again, my body wouldn't be found until late in the following winter when they got to the back row of the hay shed. Unless they were alerted by the crows picking my carcass. I tell you these stories just to illustrate the fact that ideas can be dangerous, that in ideas lies the seed of our annihilation very often. But how do you stop having them? That's another question. I had a... growing up on a farm, I spent a lot of time walking. I didn't realise until much later that I shared this habit with Wordsworth and Shelley and the like, but I did. And I think that it was there, that it was walking, that I formulated this idea about shooting the crows and building a canoe. And they formed themselves not as abstract concepts, but in the manner of a saga, a sort of South Gippsland saga, a minor saga, non-Norse. And I'm sure now that they formed themselves in rather grandiose teenage sentences, that I would be telling my friends of how I'd shot this crow from only 3 feet away, according to an incredible jungle strategy of mine. And I now think, because I've had much more evidence, in fact I'm quite sure, that most of us think in sentences, that really our thoughts are inseparable from the language which is embedded in our brains. There may be people who don't think in sentences, I'm sure there are many, but for the most part we do, and we write, you know, we think as we write. That's why sometimes we pick up something we've written and think, God, I don't remember ever thinking that. How did I think such a complex thought? Well, we thought such a complex thought because we were writing at the time and the sentences carried us there. Which is why language is terribly important, and it's now endemic debasement, I think, is a path to misery, possibly. Misery for those of us who like it, at least. Now, you'll notice probably that I don't have PowerPoint. If I had PowerPoint, I'd be able... I apologise for not having PowerPoint. It'll be harder for you to go to sleep, I hope. If I had PowerPoint, I could show you this slide, and you can see without PowerPoint how useless a slide is, because I can hardly see it here. But you'll see there are a lot of arrows and things everywhere, and it says ANSF Tactical, ANFS Institutional, Tribal Governance, Coalition Domestics, Population Conditions. It's an extraordinarily complex slide, and it illustrates the Allied position in Afghanistan in about 2008. It's a how to win the war slide of 5 years ago. General McChrystal, who was the general at that time, said, "When we understand this slide, we'll have won the war." For which I imagine that may have been one of the reasons he was dismissed or moved on. Now, the strange thing about this slide is that it's very like this slide, except this slide is smaller. You'll see the same circles, sort of bullet points dotted everywhere, arrows going in all directions. But instead of talking about ANSF tactical and population conditions and belief, it says healthy snacks, new sports equipment, body image training and things of that kind. It's actually, it's a fun and healthy in Moreland impact audit about the same time as this slide in Afghanistan was made. It's about school lunches. Now, the thing about PowerPoint and management language in general is that it's totally transferable. You can use it for anything. You can use the local mothers' club or the CIA can make use of this language. You just take a few phrases and stitch them together and you're right. And politicians can use it as well, businessmen, journalists, people of all stripes. Now, PowerPoint seems to me the most brutal of all the devices used to attack the language. I learned this afternoon, 30 million, this is as of about the time these Afghanistan slides were made, 30 million PowerPoint presentations a day worldwide. So it's really, you know, that would be far more than poems read, for instance. Or even, you know, the roughest doggerel wouldn't compete with that. So really we are now communicating in our work and in our political relationships and our social relationships through PowerPoint as much as anything else. The difference between PowerPoint and ordinary language, the differences are many, but one of the more notable ones is the absence of verbs in PowerPoint, in fact, the absence of sentences. And as I was saying before, it's in sentences that we actually think. Now, you take sentences away and something happens. There's a guru at Harvard called Edward Tufte who has written quite a lot on PowerPoint, and he says it's actually possible to measure the decline in cognitive ability of the American business classes through the use of PowerPoint. He talks about it as anaesthetizing, as being generic, mushy, simplistic, basically useless, a good way to show slides. Because in the old way, you know, the slides used to fall out or you'd put them in upside down. But it has that in common with the old slide night, which was when, you know, you had to go around to the neighbours to see their slides of their most recent overseas trip or trip to Victoria or something like that, and you knew it would be incredibly boring and you hoped that you could get a bit of sleep in an armchair. Tufte says, you know, the PowerPoint simply can't convey complex ideas, and it's easy enough to demonstrate this by imagining the Gettysburg Address, for instance, done in PowerPoint. Try and think of it in PowerPoint. Somebody tried, and it just won't work. It won't. Or you know, think of Churchill. Here is Winston Churchill in 1940. We all remember these words. "We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight in the air. We shall defend our island. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." Now, those words, it seems perhaps silly to some people, but I think probably those words, as much as anything else, with the exception perhaps of the Spitfire and other scientific developments, saved the world. They actually woke England up and the rest of the world up. They probably got quite a few of a previous generation to go and fight, to join the army. They're extraordinary words, but what's so remarkable about them is that it's full of verbs and repeated verbs, but a very strong verb, and they're entirely concrete. Churchill understood instinctively, like anyone who is interested in writing and speech understands, that all language is concrete if it's to be any good to us at all. That's entirely concrete. So he actually talks about people's lives and mundane places where we're going to fight. Done in PowerPoint, it would have begun with the verb "we shall fight," and then it would have been a series of dots about the places. Beach, landing grounds, France. And I think they would have just all gone back to whatever they were doing, cricket or something, and then nothing would have happened. And I don't know what the world would be like now. And if you take, they're very old examples, but if you take Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, or even more, the second inaugural, you can read it 1,000 times and you can actually see how Lincoln is thinking as he goes. It's an incredibly complex argument he mounts, which no politician now would understand, quite frankly. You can follow his thought standing in the Lincoln Memorial, and it's engraved on the wall, and you can just see the way. It's phenomenal. With PowerPoint, it would never have been made. So the question is, why have we given up on language? And I don't have an answer to that. But if you want another demonstration of the power of PowerPoint, and in a way it's the realization of McLuhan's prediction that the machine would take over, the machine would do the thinking, and we would simply become the machine, if you like, but a useless machine, like a piece of old agricultural equipment lying in a corner of a paddock. But you'll remember that we went to the Iraq War after Colin Powell addressed the UN in what is now called, it was one of the famous presentations, as we now call speaking. Colin Powell, against his better judgment, went and presented the PowerPoint slides to demonstrate that Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. And these are his words as the slides changed. "How do I know that? How can I say that? Let me give you a closer look." Click. Close up. Close up of Winnebago. "Look at the image on the left. On the left is a close-up of one of the four chemical bunkers. The two arrows indicate the presence of sure signs that the bunkers are storing chemical weapons." But they don't. They're just two arrows. They're just arrows. They're just PowerPoint arrows. And you can imagine the whole assembled gathering of those people who are going to decide the fate of millions saying, that convinces me. There are two arrows pointing to two points on this picture, and they must be chemical weapons. Now, if you can convince people of that, well, you know the power of PowerPoint. Now, I don't want to pick on any politician at all. Least of all Julia Gillard, but among contemporary politicians. But when Julia Gillard spoke in public, she spoke like a PowerPoint presentation. She spoke like bullet points. Now, everyone knew that that's not the way. She couldn't speak like that to a friend or to colleagues or anyone else. She couldn't have persuaded them to any position speaking like that. And she ran the most difficult government there's ever been. So she must have had wonderful powers of persuasion, but the strange thing was that when she spoke to the rest of the community, she spoke in bullet points. And no one could bear it. Well, I couldn't bear it. And you thought, why? These cadences were so oppressive that you thought, please stop. And I think she was the first politician to actually speak in PowerPoint presentations. She was also the first one to stand in front of the Labour Party's slogan in 2000 and what was it, 10? And the slogan was lifted straight from the management handbook going forwards. Now, this was a Labour Party slogan. Right? Once, if they wanted to put forwards in it, they might have just put forwards. Forward! Exclamation mark. Or forward ho! Or something. But going forwards is sort of, is so, it is so dead. It just, you close your eyes at once and try not to think. So in the effect of PowerPoint and management language on politics has really been to give us the impression that politicians don't own their words, that they're not master of their own thoughts, if you know what I mean. That this is coming from somewhere else. So halfway through that campaign in 2010, Julie Gillard's advisers decided that they should... Something was going wrong. They weren't getting the right impression, so they announced that it would be the real Julia from now on. And this was a wretched decision for her. I mean, it made her look abominably silly. And, well, she got elected somehow, but she wasn't helped. So we now are used to watching politicians and other public figures speak in a way that we simply do not engage with. In other words, all the possibilities of language have dropped out of it. It's now it's so depleted and so predictable and so on message that we're either bored by it or simply offended. Now, I could talk about PowerPoint for another 3.5 hours, but I won't. What time is it? If the first thought that comes into your mind when you're writing or even speaking to someone, if the first thing that enters your mind is a slogan or a cliche, then nothing much else will find its way in. I think that is sort of self-evidently true, which means that you're not actually going to have any ideas if you're only thinking in clichés. It's like stuffing an old darn sock in your mouth. You may as well, for all the good it's going to do. This is attractive to politicians, and it's attractive to anybody who has to speak without really wanting to say anything or not being sure of what they can say or whether, in fact, they have anything to say at all. So if the first words that come into your mouth are the habitual words like issue. I foolishly subscribed to Foxtel, and every now and again a sign comes on there on a blank screen saying, "We are currently experiencing an issue." That's their standard sign, "We are currently experiencing an issue." And you just sit there waiting for the issue to go away without ever knowing what the issue is. Worse, on Qantas, I tell you this is true, we were sitting on the tarmac for a long while one day and it said, whoever speaks to you on Qantas said, "We're currently experiencing an issue and we will let you know when we have an outcome." Which is combining those two words very well. And all he left out was impact. And for which everyone on the plane was glad, no doubt. But you see, we wouldn't have countenanced using a word like issue without saying what the issue was once. We would have 24 words to describe the issue. Now, issue will do. The same goes for outcome. You know, we would have said consequence or effect or many other sorts of words, which more exactly describe what it is that we're trying to describe. And same with impact. You know, asteroids have an impact when they hit the Earth, but now so does virtually anything. I'm probably having an impact now without even knowing it, a very minor impact, I'm sure, but it's still an impact. So what you have in management language is really a surrogate for thought. It simulates thought. It makes, you know, it obeys that tendency we all have to be pompous when we're speaking publicly, but pomposity is one thing, but this sort of pseudo-scientific style of management speak is a different thing altogether. If I can give you an example for which a combination of management speak and academia is probably responsible, this comes from the University of Bristol, and I emphasise university. "Ongoing parallel qualitative work indicates that explicit consideration of personal values attached to potential outcomes challenges women's perceptions of the optimal decision, and this may influence their resolve to achieve a vaginal birth." Now, the extraordinary thing about that sentence is that vaginal birth is the very last thing you were expecting at the end. I mean, it's, talk about hiding the message, you know, it's sort of... By the time you get there, I mean, it is a total mystery, but the sort of mystery that you're not in the slightest bit interested in. You know, it's just, oh, here we go again, here's another sentence, and then it ends up with that. Now, that's sort of... the hospitals, this language, of course, you know, began in boardrooms of corporations and in, you know, probably drug-crazed consultancies forming like nebula on the coast of California or somewhere. But it ends up in hospitals where you now have birth events and death events and adverse patient outcomes, which can be amputating the wrong leg or death quite often. A death event, I should say. We don't die, we have a death event, as you know now. In Melbourne, what used to be the Register of Births, Deaths and Marriages is now... it's got events in it. Marriage event. Divorce event. Marriage event. On and on. Now, Orwell anticipated some of this in Politics in the English Language, the greatest essay on the language that I've ever read, and which you can see is the beginnings of his dystopian... comedies, dark comedies, 1984 and Animal Farm. But Orwell always imagined this sort of language in a totalitarian context, that only people living in a totalitarian society would become complicit in a language like this because their lives depended on it. What is extraordinary, and that no one could have anticipated, I don't think in 1946 at least, was that democracies would take this on, that we would become complicit in this of our own free will, it seems. Not entirely, because really the purpose of this language in its basic state is to pull everybody into buying... what's it called? Buy-in. Buy-in, that's right. So you've got to buy in. Get your values aligned with your goals, and your goals with your vision, and your vision with your mission. And if there's any misalignment, we'll just move the mission slightly to one side. Don't be so ambitious. Bring it back a bit. Get your goals... that sort of thing. Now, what we're really describing in some ways is the sort of Faustian bargain we make with technology, that as we are sort of giving in, I'm afraid, to the machine, it's inevitable, and to an internet which really does our thinking for us and so on. Now, I'm very conscious of the danger of becoming an old fogey if it hasn't already happened, and... or sounding too negative or too curmudgeonly. But I do think it's worth asking ourselves what it means to give up language, to be now content to hear our elected representatives or our local council or whatever, or the CEOs who seem to be appointed in every little town now and who talk in the same language over and over again, or to go to a hospital and to put up with it, or have our children taught mission statements in grade two, or have their essays described as product, and for all of us to be called consumers rather than whatever we were before, but we certainly weren't consumers. That was only when we went shopping, but now I suppose we shop all the time, so we are consumers. But how did that happen? I don't know. Certainly language had something to do with it. Now, I'm editing as I go. I imagine that most of the ideas at this conference have been concerned with the future, I suspect. I don't think many ideas would be concerned with it. I would like to think so, but ideas for better lives, for more exciting lives, for deeper knowledge of the human condition, of the universe, I'm sure. I always think of the future and little hovercraft appear and personalised drones and Disney comics sort of view of things, apps for your mobile phone that will... I have one that's called an assistive light. It's a torch. It comes up, assistive light, and it flashes. And you, sister, I'll just get my assistive light out. You're in need of assistiveness. They'll have one soon that will put out household fires, I'm sure, and that sort of thing. But anyway, if you... I think... I don't find the future all that useful. I used to think the future was useful because it helped me forget about what I might have had to do, like go to the dentist or something. So I'd imagine, well, in an hour's time in the future, this will be over, and chances are I'll still be alive. Even if bleeding, I'll be all right. That is the main function. And then I found, to my delight, that no lesser individual than Seneca said, only idiots think about the distant future. It's idiotic for human beings to think about the future. So I immediately became a Stoic. As of about 2 o'clock this afternoon, when I found the quote, actually. He said, the point being that we cannot know it. And in fact, all our philosophical traditions tend to say, to emphasize the uncertainty of life and how to live with it, how to live with not knowing what's going to happen, how to live with accidents, even if we now always, you know, feel compelled to say, I did this because of such and such a reason. You know how politicians never had good luck, they only had bad. I know quite a few like that. And it's just nonsense. But we really don't know. And what's interesting to us, what's great about 19th century novels or about Montaigne or anything you like, about Nietzsche, is the uncertainty, the paradoxes on which we thrive. You know, the Book of Job is a paradox. You know, that's a foundation document of the Judeo-Christian culture that Peter Costello was very keen to tell us we inherited as he was dealing with a neoliberal economy. These are all about paradox and uncertainty and our feebleness in the face of nature. This idea that, you know, you just have to have a dream and live the dream and everything will be fine is, I think, as stupid as it can get. Therefore, I mean, my argument is, well, how do we keep some, that useful part of the past alive in a world which is only now concerned with the future and with pushing ahead? Now, if you want an example of what I mean, if you look at the average university mission statement or vision statement, I don't know the difference between the two, but you must have both, you will see that it is only concerned with the future. Well, the ones I've looked at are. And it's as if a university no longer has any responsibility to preserve what's best in the heritage of the culture. And this is also reflected in the withering away of history departments, English departments, classics departments. Try and find a good Norse saga in a university now. Now, I know this makes me sound very old and decrepit, probably, but it's... I have this sense that with language so debased and depleted, that this is not in any way separate from the debasement of our understanding of the past and our reverence for it, if you like. That if you don't any longer recognize the sacredness of language and the possibilities of language, the comic and lyric possibilities of language, the descriptive possibilities, the endless possibilities of language, including the simple one of communicating, then an awful lot goes out with it, and it's no small thing. I'm not talking about grammar, I'm just talking about meaning. It's not something to readily give up. Maybe it makes no difference, I don't know. But I think it does. So what I'm sort of recommending is that we give up this management stuff. You know, my first idea for this evening is no PowerPoint for a week. Maybe a verb retrieval day. A national one. Get us thinking about verbs again and what they can do as opposed to non-verbs. And maybe an active voice week, you know. But whatever you do, go back, not forwards. Instead of going forwards, think about going backwards for a while. It won't hurt. And everybody else does it.
When you think about it, I mean, the neoliberal economy which we now inhabit, after all, we went back to find it. We went back to Adam Smith 200 years ago, really, to find it, and we just took God out and just called the invisible hand something else. And when it sort of failed us very badly in the great financial crisis, we went back to Keynes to try and prop it up, and we're still trying to prop it up with government interventions, which, of course, were absolutely verboten for 15 years. So, of course, everyone else goes back. Why shouldn't we? It's just, you know, plain crazy. I mean, don't be a consumer. I don't think we should. I think we should just object. I don't know how you object, but, for instance, I received a letter not such a long while ago from a... Yes, here it is. A dear valued customer. It's not actually. I mean, I don't know why he didn't write valued customer. He wrote, dear 28 Grandview Street. And it came from Primus Telecom, and it says, we have placed your application on hold within our systems while the works are performed. The estimated completion date is TBA. However, this date may be moved forward or back depending on demand and availability of equipment. Now, when Orwell talked about language being debased to the point of being like a prefabricated hen house, you know, whether you just take a piece and tack it onto that bit and that bit, he hadn't that in mind. I don't think he could have gone that far. But it comes from someone who is simply working at the absolute minimum level, you know, of thought. He doesn't need to. He's just using... It is a bloke, by the way. He signed his name, Max, his name is. And when you do debase language that much, that meaning and irony and all those possibilities just vanish. And that has always remained one of the best examples. Here is another one. Entitlement to the tax offset is dealt with in proposed section, which provides that a person will be entitled to the offset if the person has a child event in relation to a child. Second dot point, the person did not have a child event in respect of another child and at that time also satisfied the following conditions. Here's one from Adelaide, from the Bureau of Meteorology. In Adelaide, more thunderstorms were recorded than normal. In fact, we had 4 events of thunderstorms compared to our normal 1 event in January. Now, it used to be... You see what I'm saying? I mean, it was quite, you could turn on the radio once and say, well, we had a thunderstorm last night. Did you hear the thunderstorm? My God, it was loud, you know. You would talk about the thunderstorm. No one ever felt the necessity to say it was an event of thunderstorms. And the old verb, to be born or to die, you know, was good enough. You didn't have to have a death event or an adverse event. Similarly, the church didn't need to align its values with the person of Jesus Christ, but they do now. At the Sacred Heart College in Geelong, there is a strong Catholic identity and witness to Christian values, ensuring that our mission, shared beliefs and our core values align with the person of Jesus Christ. It's amazing. The Anglican Diocese of Sydney lost about $400 million. I don't know how that could possibly happen given the New Testament, but during the great financial crisis, but they did. And they got in Boston Consulting, and it was on the front page of the Financial Review a few months ago, saying that Boston Consulting had been horrified and told them that they must substitute a culture of forgiveness for a culture of accountability. So, bugger the Beatitudes, out the window. We're on. So, I have thousands of them here, but I won't go into them. Yeah, they're addictive. Well, Cardinal Pell signed his Advent letter 3 years ago. I haven't seen the more recent ones. May the Lord be with you going forward. He did. Now, in the whole history of the Roman Catholic Church, as far as I know, it's never been felt necessary to add going forwards to the blessing. You know, that it was just assumed that it wasn't much point saying maybe the Lord be with you in the past. You know, it stood to reason. But anyway, all it means is that he subcontracts. You know, he's outsourced the Advent letter, and this is how it's come back. And he didn't bother to read it. Maybe, I don't know. Now, I have a more complex bit here, but I think I might be running out of time. Let me just give you one example of... I'm sorry, this was so well organised when I came here. Oh, damn. Here we are. There's a book written a while ago called The Autobiography of a Schizophrenic Girl, and in this, the psychiatrist described the girl's language and language which is consistent with the condition as a form of linguistic alienation. He said, in her world, words echoed hollowly, deprived of all meaning. Each word seemed to be an envelope emptied of content, a sign divorced from its object. R.D. Lang called this kind of language simply nonsense, red herring speech, prolonged filibustering to throw dangerous people off the scent, to create boredom and futility in others. Now, there's more. It's a language that in its emphatic self-sufficiency stands as an epitome of isolation and self-involvement. Now, I can't think of a more perfect definition of modern management language and particularly political language. I can't think of a better description of the last election. Now, I don't know what the consequences of that are if schizophrenic speech is the same as modern political speech, but it doesn't sound like the healthiest sign for a democracy in which it's sort of assumed we take it as a given that the right to know is part of a democracy. But the ability to know is presumably an essential before the right can be exercised. So I think it's now very hard for us to know anything, including what the person on your TV screen is thinking. And I just want to make one other point in case you think that this is just language and has no political or any other social consequences. During the Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria, we were warned about the coming wind events, heat events, and consequent fire events, and the combination of heat events and wind events, the Premier was telling us. But no one was actually warned in a way that they understood, and many people died. We got some idea about why this was when the Royal Commission was held, and the man in charge of the whole affair said this: my view of the world is, you know, I take the advice that we could have said things differently and put more information. My view of the world is that for those people who are in that environment, the weather conditions were very plain to understand. We had very clearly communicated the fuel conditions. I think the bet, if you think about it, in terms of the fire triangle, was that we had not communicated the likely outcome. Now, read that several times, and you'll realise that what he's trying to say is we didn't tell them to get out. We didn't say this was going to be a horrible fire. Now, questioned by counsel assisting the commission, it got worse and worse. It became truly horrifying to hear them speak. They talked about what they were doing on the day was populating the template. They were adding value. They were doing all sorts of things, but they weren't telling anybody to go for your life. And eventually, counsel said, why didn't you just describe what a fire is like to these people? And they said, well, there had never been a fire like it. But he said, well, yes, there has. And, I mean, he could have gone to Dante, I suppose, or... but instead, he brought in the Royal Commission report on the 1939 Black Friday fires and read it out to them. And it contained this sort of stuff. On the day it appeared, the whole state was alight at midday. In many places, it was dark as night. Steel girders and machinery were twisted by heat as if they had been of fine wire. Sleepers of heavy, durable timber set in the soil, their upper surfaces flush with the ground, were burnt through. Blown by a wind of great force, they roared as they travelled. The speed of the fires was appalling. They leapt from mountain peak and so on and so on. The way you would describe a fire, if you were trying to tell people that given the conditions that were going to... Everyone knew it was coming on that Saturday. You would say, you're not going to be able to fight this with a hose. But that was never said. And when they said, well, there'd never been a fire like this, what they meant was, sadly, was that they simply no longer had the language to warn people, which is the first thing we ever said was look out, or hot, or something like that. And that, they'd all been to management school. And they no longer knew how to say, run for your life. You can't fight this fire. It was astonishing. Now, you can find that sort of thing, I think you'll find repeated over and over again, you know, in many different contexts, especially the educational one, and I wish I had time to go into it, but I don't. And I think that's probably enough from me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What an excellent speech event, eh?
Yeah.
I'd like just to stick with what you're talking about, which is you can understand when someone's before a Royal Commission that basically everyone fudges, probably always did. But you're an historian, and even if we go back as far as, say, Hawke and Keating, you were in the office, there was clarity. It was clarity of political thought, and the management jargon hadn't got in. What happened? When did it happen, and how did we run for our lives?
Well, it's a good question. The management jargon actually had got in, but there were still a few people, including the Prime Minister, who hated it. I mean, that's one of Paul Keating's great gifts. His language, and it's perhaps because he hadn't been to management school or to university or anywhere else that, you know, he still had a gift for the vernacular and a basic understanding that you can't sell anything without words properly arranged. And I mean, I think he sold the whole notion of deregulation and the economic reforms in a sort of cartoon language. You know, he liked these images of people running and being... He loved the roadrunner and the coyote, and he would use this sort of thing. And you know, he always had levers being pulled and the switches to vaudeville and J-curves starting in Cairns and running down here. So he sort of made the whole thing sort of concrete. It was laughable at times and very easy to satirise, but it really did stick it in people's minds. So I think, you know, he's always... For some reason, people always laugh at the fact that he said we were headed to be a banana republic. But as he said, I imprinted it on their brains. They knew that we had to change or we'll be down the gurgler.
And I do remember there was a whole 18 months when people would actually go around and in normal, on a tram or on a bus, they would be talking about the J-curve.
Absolutely.
It got through.
Yeah.
It got through.
And they'd be watching the boats going out through Port Phillip Bay Heads and others coming in and thinking about the, you know, the trade-weighted index or something, you know.
Yeah.
But...
So what went wrong?
Well... I mean, one of the things that has happened in politics and began to happen with the economic reforms of the 80s was that everybody in the political office had to have a PhD in economics. There's a bunch of economists and a few journos who have decided to have a holiday in the media office. And that was really about the sum total. And I think... there were fewer and fewer people there, like old mandarins who'd been, you know, had a proper education, saying, well, hang on, chaps, we better put this in proper English. And, you know, I think the other thing that has happened is that, you know, saying to you earlier, Jennifer, when I left, in 1996, I'd never sent or read an email. Someone came around when we were moving out of the office and downloaded all these things off my computer, and I didn't know what they were. There was about 3,000 emails that had come from the department, and I'd never opened my email. I had no idea what they were. We never used them.
It's inspiring, isn't it?
That's literally the truth. I'd never done it. I mean, I'd seen PAs sending, ding, 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 as they were doing dial-up, trying to send a speech across, but it rarely worked. So you'd get on the, just fax it, you know. Now, of course, I mean, and we felt under siege constantly from the media, and, you know, like every little fax or media story was, you know, a potential bomb. Now, there are millions of these things come through every day with just the same dangers inherent in them. I don't know how they manage all the information. And I think that's where, I mean, the technology is actually making life for the language very difficult, because you really do want these bromides just to throw out there and shut people up and say as little as you can, and the role of the person who's messaging you all the time is there.
By and large, you weren't imputing motivation, by and large, with what you're describing as what happened. And occasionally there's a darker purpose, maybe. But in the Orwellian universe, there is a very dark purpose. There's actually, it's quite a deliberate thing that when you no longer have the word for torture, then the notion of torture goes. Or when you debase the meaning of love, and you make the ministry of love actually the place that administers hate, you have actually done real damage to the language first, but in fact to the fabric. Do you think there is a level of the sinister in this, or it is just kind of mucking through and not caring enough?
I don't know. I suppose when something sinister happens, we'll think it's sinister. And I mean, I think what is happening is sinister. And I think there is... I think management language has a sinister purpose. I think it pretends to be... I mean, all its words are about involvement, innovation, creativity, everyone feeling part of the team, teamwork, all that. Really what it is a way of pulling everybody in to be, as they say, on the same page. And if you don't like it, get out. And if you don't use... The language is actually the sign that you haven't bought into it. If you're not using the same phrases, the same messages, the same nonsense the most recent consultant who went through gave you, then you're an outsider, which is very like the sort of totalitarian situation where your language, if you weren't using the right slogans, it gave you away. There's a wonderful example in Anne Applebaum's book about the Gulag, where people, the commissars in the Gulag, for a few years, described the death of people, explained the death of people by this term, failure of the heart muscle. Now, of course, we all die, ultimately, of failure of the heart muscle. No, really, I mean, it's not working, that's for sure, when we're dead. But what failure of the heart muscle doesn't describe is the fact that it was murder, that this is state-sponsored abuse and murder and atrociousness of an incredible order. Now, in a way, the same thing happens when people in any organisation are forced to attend to this sort of nonsense and write this stuff, and they do. And they will tell you, people in departments and in private sector corporations will say, if we write this stuff and send it upstairs, it'll come back to us saying, where is the message? Where are these terms? Why aren't you using these phrases? And so that's what you get over and over again. And they give speeches in this and people turn up and pretend to listen. I read a speech of Arthur Sinodinos's the other night, and you thought, well, old Arthur will be, you know, he'll be, have a bit of a care for the language, but no, it's just straight out of the management textbook. Same old stuff, change of government, but no change of anything else, you know.
So what can ordinary people do about it? I mean, how do you fight back against that kind of debasement? Because, I mean, apart from driving you mad, you can actually often see when they're sending you some document, you can see them weaseling out of responsibility. Mm. You can see if something goes wrong in this building that they've notified you and it's completely gobbledygook to you what it actually signifies, but you know, sure as hell, if the plumbing fails, you're not going to be, they're not going to be liable. You're going to be responsible. So you can sniff it, you can hear it. What do you do about it?
I honestly don't know. I mean, you know, if you read Kafka, there's nothing you can do about it. You're trapped. There's no way out. I don't know. I don't know how many times I've talked about this. And people, there's a general loathing of it all, but there's also total helplessness. And I think it's because, you know, in a way, if you walk down the street with a banner saying, you know, save the verb or something, you're not going to get a hell of a lot of attention.
Oh, you would, but not the kind you want.
No, not the kind you want. No. No one is going to really take it that seriously. And I think the sad thing is that those places where you would hope it might be defended, like a university or an education system, are the places which have most zealously rolled over and taken it on.
Listening to you, you know, you're talking about the future. I mean, I think that's really... And it just occurred to me, we already have the language of the future. We actually know it. We see it on our screens, we see it on our phones, particularly with our kids doing it. The language of the future is already there, even as we lose the language of the past, and quite possibly we'll lose the retention system of the past, which is writing, which is actually the thing under real threat. They haven't perverted it, but it is under threat. So maybe the one good thing to be said about the obsession with the future is, because everything is few characters and tight and abbreviations, maybe there'll be less crap in there. Maybe there'll be less managerial crap. Possible?
Well, it's a flicker of hope. Maybe. I often imagine that, you know, in some sort of dystopian future where those who are still speaking English as she is spoken will be living under freeways with, you know, and probably having their own little FM, like a little wireless set, or an FM radio or something, you know, communicating secretly in sentences. And I can't... You know, be like those people who still like listening to Vivaldi or something. But I don't know. People tell me, who was it? What's his name? Maine, you know, in the journalist.
Stephen Maine
told me about 3 years ago, look, it's had a terrific effect. You know, people are very, very conscious of it. You know, the books in the, you know, the corporate libraries and, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's had no effect at all. You go and talk, and they write to you thanking you sometimes, although thanking you is very rare, and it's in exactly the same language. They don't say dear valued client or something, but it's never going to go. And it has a lot to do with power. I think it's very interesting. If you go into a private or public organisation, it's very often the women in that organisation who recognise it and laugh most when you read it out. It's that laughter of recognition. And there are always half a dozen blokes who look very pissed off about the whole thing, which I think illustrates that it is a question of power. You know, that who is this bloke coming in here and sending our stuff up? Because it's taken on a great meaning for them. And if you take on this really arcane stuff and you master it, then no one can come near you, really. You've got it.
The new Freemasonry.
Yeah.
I've been told I've got to stop asking questions, and you're allowed to. I'm sorry if I've hogged any of your time. Who would like? Is there any questions? Yes, madam. I'll repeat the question. The question is, because I'm sure not all of you have heard it. The question was from a woman, may I point out. Is the solution to get up and just say, I don't understand a word you're saying, and should the media be following that practice also?
Well, I think the answer is very simple, yes. And there was a case on the BBC breakfast show 6 or 7 years ago, and I can't remember the name of the journalist, but I think he asked the minister 11 times, what do you mean, in the one interview, and never got an answer, but at least it made the point. And I know it's very—it's hard for journalists to do this because, you know, you want him to come back. You depend on these people, and if you send them too deep into hiding, you might, you know, burn your best interests. But I think it would be a good idea. Again, it may be a national week of what do you mean, you know, where they're really... I think the idea of national days is good, you know. Look how ANZAC has worked after all this time.
I think the question you're referring, the answer was the 6-point plan, the opposition.
Six-point
plan.
Yeah.
And that's what happens with too much PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Another example.
Don, I have a problem of this uncertainty. And I always wanted to ask you personally, did you write it or did Paul write it?
Which one?
The Redfern speech.
Yeah, I wish you hadn't asked me that question. I was his speechwriter, so what do you think?
Well, Paul says the opposite.
No, he doesn't say the opposite. He says something different. let me explain what he says. And it came as a great surprise to me when this outburst occurred about 3 years ago. What a speechwriter does is write a speech and hand it in the same way that an economics advisor or a social advisor or a foreign policy advisor gives a prime minister advice, except the speechwriter's is formally composed. It's in the form of a speech. The prime minister decides which parts or all of it or whatever he's going to use of the speech is his decision. At that point, it becomes his speech. The Redfern speech and all those other speeches, every single speech, and I've always said this, are Paul's speeches. All the speeches that I wrote for Cain are Cain's speeches. There's no question. There need never be a question of this kind. Just as people don't say that Kennedy's inaugural was written by Ted Sorensen. It's Kennedy's speech, but everyone knows Sorensen wrote it. If you're interested, Sorensen was his speechwriter. But it becomes the politician's speech because the politician makes the judgment, as he does with all other advice, about which parts of it he can use and which not. Then it's true that the speeches often evolve from conversations, you know, in the office or wherever. But the difficulty with this is that because I wrote a book about it, I couldn't very well pretend that I was doing anything much else but writing speeches. I couldn't say, well, while I was paid to be a speechwriter, I was looking after the rose garden.
Yes, but you created it, and that's what I wanted to hear. Thanks.
I don't want that. I don't want that on the record.
I think you've just been railroaded.
I don't accept that I created. I accept that I was the speechwriter, and the speechwriter is, you know, does a job in the same way that it would be like saying that Chris Higgins and Don Russell created the new Australian economy. And a few others, Bernie Fraser. They didn't. Keating and Hawke did it because they took the political risk. You know, they did the politics. And that's where I think exactly the same applies with speeches.
It was a close relationship. Do you miss him? Do you miss the friendship? Do you miss the collegiate?
Yes, I do.
And when he said, if he'd known you were going to do that, as in write that very fine book, did that really hurt? He would rather not have appointed you than you did that.
I think about it. Yeah, I do. I think about it.
Was the book worth it?
Well, if I was going to write a book, I couldn't have written it any differently. I really couldn't. I wrote an afterword to the last edition in which I tried to explain exactly how I came to the idea of writing the book the way I did, rather than, you know, the magisterial history or pretending I wasn't there and all that. And it just sounded as false as a lot of political language. So I wrote it from the inside, and I paid a price. But on the other hand, I feel like, well, it was, you know, I'm not aware of anything in it that's profoundly untrue.
No. Yes. You. At the microphone.
Don, a question about in defence of the dot point, as I understand it, that politicians will reduce things to dot points because that's all the electorate can understand. Stop the boats, stop the waste, cut the tax, reduce things to three or four words. And yet, in the second sentence, every politician will say, I know my electorate is astute. They see through the crap, they're highly motivated, they're very clever, you cannot pull the wool over the electorate's eyes. There's a problem there that both of those things are saying the exact opposite. In your view, which one is true?
I think no one can doubt
I suppose, looking at the history of the 20th century, the effectiveness of slogans and things being reduced to a few, well, to a slogan, which is another reason for avoiding them. That's another reason why we should be hostile to them. The history of Germany in the 30s should be enough for us. Or, I mean, actually, I used to have someone in the Queensland Public Service used to send me secretly stuff out of the public service, and he would dress it up with, he would get those pictures of the Chinese Revolution with workers going forth carrying banners, and instead of the banners saying "Forward to Victory" or, you know, "Kill every sparrow" or whatever that was going on in the Cultural Revolution, he would put managerial slogans in. It was incredibly effective, but totally stupid, you know. So the first part, I mean, it is true, but it is also offensive. And the second part of the question about how we're astute and everything, well, I think that's just, you know, that's one of the arts of, you know, a very ancient art of persuasion, and it's called greasing in modern terminology, where you give them the hard stuff and you sound like a tough pragmatist, and then you give them the "hail fellow, well met," you know, and say, "You're really smart and, you know, you're astute. Don't think I'm pulling the wool over your eyes for a moment," you know. So I just think it's really like, you know, the double-handed handshake. I think it's pretty basic political artfulness. Yeah.
There's a... we've got to go. And recently you wrote a piece, a speech from the next Prime Minister before you knew who the new Prime Minister was. And it's just very germane to that question. There was a line in it that where you say, "I blame you, I, the Prime Minister, blame you, us. It started with you whinging. I evolved to meet your demands."
Mm.
Is that what you really think?
Yeah, I think in a way, I think that's true. I mean, I think both candidates in that last election were very, you know, they were at least playing the role of quite recently evolved politicians. I've just done another one, actually, and it's Tony Abbott's sorry speech, but you'll have to buy them by the next monthly. That's got a national day in it, too. But,
Can hardly wait. Listen, tragically, I'm really sorry, we are going to have to leave it here because it is about 6:05 and I've been told we must vacate the hall. So can I just say thank you so much for all being here, and can we all join in and thank Don Watson?
Thank you.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.